I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. In addition to being the host and creator of this show, I'm the author of two books related to Lewis. Learn more about them at the end of the show. This episode is the second of a two-part interview with Dr. Harry Lee Poe. As you might have heard, he is doing a three-part biography on C.S. Lewis. At the time this show was first posted, the second of the three volumes was recently released. It's called The Making of C.S. Lewis. Be sure to listen to part one of the interview if you haven't already. For this episode, you'll learn more about the recording Hal discovered less than 10 years ago and how to read a transcript of what we have, plus a lot more about what's covered in The Making of C.S. Lewis. To get back into things, I'm playing the last couple of minutes of the previous show before continuing with new content.
The Hobbit was a big hit, and that, I think, took Tolkien by surprise. It made money. It went into multiple editions. It was popular. And the publisher wanted another one, a new Hobbit. And so Tolkien agreed to do a new Hobbit because Tolkien needed money. His main project is always the Silmarillion, but he's going to pick up a little money on the side with this story. And of course, it becomes the Lord of the Rings. And it grows and it grows and it grows and it grows. And it's not a little children's story. It's some, I think, could rightfully argue it's the greatest literary work of the 20th century. It's certainly great in terms of popularity, but it's also great in terms of its influence and reshaping a way of modern storytelling from the point at which, when it first came out, the bookstores and the libraries didn't know where to put it. Where in the library do you put a story like this? They didn't know. But now they know, because there's a whole section in the bookstore and the library carved out because of The Lord of the Rings. But Tolkien had another problem. He started writing, and he had the birthday party, and he had the ring, and Bilbo disappears, and Tolkien doesn't know where he's gone. He does not know what in the world is going to happen. And he stalls again. And once again, Lewis comes to the rescue. We have a letter in which Lewis is writing to Owen Barfield. Barfield had done a play, I believe it was, in which he was retelling one of the old Greek myths. And Lewis said, what we really need is someone to do a retelling of the old ring mythology, the Norse ring mythology. Wagner had given it a try with his four cycle opera, The Ring of the Nibelungen. And so we have Lewis speculating on the value of retelling the ring story. And shortly after that, Tolkien begins again at the Lord of the Rings, and this time he knows what the ring is. It's a ring of power, like the ring of the Nibelheim. And with it, you can rule the world like the ring of the Nibelheim. And so he's off and running. And I'm suggesting that Lewis is responsible for the basic plot of the Lord of the Rings as well.
In a little bit here, we're going to have you talk about that broadcast recording that you discovered. But for those who are unaware of who Dr. Poe is, what else do you do besides write books about the life of C.S. Lewis?
Well, I served as the Charles Colston Professor of Faith and Culture at Union University. And my big concern is how the gospel intersects with culture, how the gospel answers the deep questions that every person and every culture is asking. And so I became interested in Lewis back in the 70s, because it seemed to me that Lewis was someone who understood the need to translate theology and biblical concepts into language that a person without a church background could understand. And he also understood the power of a story in a culture that increasingly is less able to follow a rational argument. And so I got quite interested in Lewis, not to publish about Lewis, but for Lewis's help with what I was doing. So I've done books on science and faith. I've done books on evangelism. I've done books on how we think about academic disciplines from a Christian perspective. Some people call that the integration of faith and learning. So just a range of books that deal with the intersection of the gospel and culture. I've done several books on Edgar Allan Poe. Most people don't realize that Lewis tracked Poe's conversion. They were dealing with the same issues and arriving at the same conclusions and having identical attitudes towards literary criticism and poetry. And the difference between them is that Lewis lived for 30 years after his conversion, and Poe lived for 30 days after his. But anyway, I've written on a range of things then. A few years ago, I guess it's been 20 years ago now, I looked back at my books and realized that I had referenced Lewis in everything that I had written. What I wrote about Lewis in those days tended to be shorter pieces, journal articles, that sort of thing. But I wasn't writing for Lewis scholars or people who knew Lewis. I was writing in other kinds of journals for people that I wanted to be exposed to Lewis. So you'll find my articles not in Seven or Sehnsucht or a Journal of Inkling Studies, but you'll find it in Christian Scholars Review, the Suwannee Theological Review, Preaching Magazine, all sorts of Christian ministry magazines, that sort of thing. So that's the background I've had. In 1998, I was asked to give a seminar at the C.S. Lewis Summer Institute in Oxford and Cambridge on apologetics in a postmodern world. Chuck Colson was also on the program that year, and he sat in on my seminar. And out of that, he decided to fund the chair that I now have, the Charles Colson Chair of Faith and Culture. I worked with the Lewis Foundation for a number of years, was the program director for their summer institute in 2002, 2005, and 2008, and decided that someone needed to edit a book that included the stories of Lewis's students. We all know what an impact and influence Lewis has had broadly on Christianity, but his job was as a professor. And I wondered, well, what influence did he have within his discipline? And nobody wanted to do the book, so I finally did it myself. It's called C.S. Lewis Remembered. It was published by Zondervan in 2006. My daughter, Rebecca, is the co-editor with me. And in fact, Lewis had a profound influence on education through his former students. They became masters of colleges in Oxford and Cambridge, deans in universities in the United States, leading scholars in the field of medieval and Renaissance literature. So just a huge impact on the world. And then my book, which is a coffee table book, not a scholarly book, The Inklings of Oxford. And it's a sneaky book because it's a book I designed to be sold in Oxford, and for many years, as long as it was in print, it was always in the shop window at Blackwell's. It's a gorgeous book. The photography was done by Jim Veneman, who was my colleague, professor of photojournalism here at Union. And I can brag on the photography because I had nothing to do with it. But I wanted a coffee table book for people who visited Oxford, had an interest in Lewis and Tolkien, might not be Christians. And so the photography is lavish, but my narrative explains why they were Christians. It's sort of an under the radar, latent Christianity. But it gives it's an introduction to the city of Oxford. So that's the sort of thing I've been up to the last 40 years.
Yeah, you've been quite a busy fellow, it sounds like. Well, now, returning to the making of C.S. Lewis, the next couple of chapters also overlap, which is what the other ones did that we were talking about earlier. To some extent, now, what we now know as World War II, of course, it wasn't called that when it started. This began when you pick up the story here, and this led to Lewis helping the war effort in a way that you discovered that was previously unknown. You already made reference to it in the part one of our podcast here, and this is a broadcast recording that you found, and it's now transcribed for the first time anywhere in your book. What can you tell us about that, as well as the other things going on in his life?
Well, I've been collecting Lewis for years, first editions and ephemera and that sort of thing. When I first started, eBay was brand new and everyone was cleaning out their closets, and you could pick up virtually anything and everything. And it was pretty easy collecting all the first editions of Lewis. But one day, golly, how long ago has it been now? Up on eBay popped a recording, a C.S. Lewis recording, The Norse Spirit in English Literature. Well, I knew Lewis well enough to know that he never gave a lecture on the Norse spirit in English literature, and he never made a recording of the Norse spirit in English literature. Only he did. I bought the record just to see what on earth it was. It was a bookstore in Iceland, in Reykjavik. And sure enough, it's C.S. Lewis. And in a letter to his friend Arthur Greaves in May of 1941, he mentions the fact that he had heard his voice for the first time on a recording. Now, he did the radio talks for the BBC later that year. So this is a number of months before. It's confused people as to what on earth he was talking about. And some people suggest that it was just a sound test. But you wouldn't have a sound test so many months before, and you wouldn't necessarily record a sound test. But there was no other explanation. And I'm indebted to Holly Ordway, who found a comment Tolkien made shortly after this to his son, and he's in a bit of a sniff, and he's upset about nobody asked me to make recordings on the Norse, and I know a lot more about it. That's sort of the attitude. That's not a direct quotation, but that's the sense of it. So apparently the Inklings knew he had done this, and it's a fascinating little recording. Unfortunately, the lecture was a two record lecture, and I only have one of the records. In those days, for continuity, you would have side one on record one, side two on record two, side three on record one, and side four on record two, so that you had two turntables going at the same time, and you could switch from one to the other and then flip the records. It was a different day back then. But it's a fascinating lecture. And you don't really find Lewis developing this idea anywhere else or publishing it. And it's sort of an informal thing. It's not a so much a scholarly work as a popular impression of the relationship between the Norse spirit of freedom, independence, and how that had an impact on the English, and why the English are different from the continental Europeans, and why English democracy is different from European democracy, and that the Norse would not put up with a ten-horned dictator. They were independent, and so it's quite fascinating the way he applies it to Hitler. But he argues that you find this contempt of the self-important person all through English literature, such as in Dickens, Mr. Bumble, in Oliver Twist, the self-important bureaucrat. But you would find it in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night with Malvolio, the house steward, who believes that his mistress has fallen in love with him, in this sense of self-importance over all the others. And Lewis himself, though he very rarely discussed politics, had this contempt for the bureaucrat who considered themselves self-important. And so it's fascinating record, but you'll find the text there given in the book.
Ah, yes, very fascinating. And now, as someone who has worked professionally in radio, my first time in it was in the 1980s. We were still using turntables, and it is much more convenient when you do have two, because you can go from one to another. By then we were actually using reel-to-reel or cassette tapes for different ministry things and whatnot. But this was in Christian radio. But yeah, it's frustrating that you only have half, but not a complete half. You have side one and side three, right?
Yes, too bad.
So we don't have the conclusion, and we just have the first part and the middle part, but it's now in your book for the first time, so people can have a chance to discover something that is nowhere else but in your book. Well, now your final two chapters take us up to the end of World War I, up to 1945, and this is, of course, well before the publication of the first Narnia book. So, you know, but this is by no means a boring part in Lewis's life, as he became famous during this time for the Screwtape Letters. Touch on that and whatever else comes to your mind from these years that you want to highlight.
One of the things that strikes me about Lewis's wartime years is that he is so incredibly productive and creative, and yet he's doing things that other people are asking him to do. And what we often think of as his apologetics, the problem of pain, mere Christianity, miracles, were not books that or projects that he undertook himself. That is, they were things someone else asked him to do. And so the problem of pain, he was approached by the publisher. They knew that the war was going to be ghastly, and Lewis had lived through one war, and he knew what to expect. And they wanted him to write a little book to prepare the British for the suffering that was going to come. So he did. It was a sense of duty. And this is part of what he picked up from his reading of the medieval romances, the sense of duty and do what you're called upon to ask, no matter how inconvenient it may be. So the problem of pain, the same with mere Christianity. He was called upon to do the radio broadcasts, and he agreed to do it. And then miracles, this his most philosophical work. He wrote it toward the end of the war. It wasn't published until after the war, but he wrote it during the war. Dorothy L. Sayers confronted him in a letter and said, "What we need is a book about miracles that makes the case, and you're the man to do it. And so he did it. He wrote it. He had been deeply concerned throughout the war period with an attitude towards science that didn't have anything to do with science, but had to do with a materialist philosophy that was laid on top of the science and was separate from the science. But people were confused and tended to associate the materialism with the scientific enterprise. Lewis loved science. He adored it. He was fascinated by it, particularly Einstein's theory of relativity, which he thought had such powerful theological implications. Nonetheless, he undertook miracles. So he's doing these things because people are asking him to, but also his imagination is being sparked. At the same time, Charles Williams has come up to Oxford. Williams gives a lecture on Paradise Lost. Lewis is inspired and decides he's going to give a series of lectures on Paradise Lost. And that then becomes his book, a preface to Paradise Lost, still in print, still a key text for understanding epic poetry. But that spawned something else, this whole idea of the great temptation of Adam and Eve and the experience of temptation. And so in that same context, he does the Screwtape Letters, which is an exploration of temptation. It's not a theology of demons. It is a reflection on the nature of temptation. And then he does Paralandra, which is a supposal. Suppose there were a world in which the people had not yet succumbed to temptation. What would that be like? What would it be like for them to be tempted and yet not succumb? And so that's his supposal. And again, it's a retelling of Paradise Lost, yet without the fall. And then there's the great divorce. Suppose the inmates of hell could take a day trip to heaven. And it's not a theology of heaven and hell. It's a theology of temptation, because what he does once the inmates get to heaven, there's an exploration of how they happen to wind up in hell, choices they made, and temptations to which they succumbed. And so all of that related to Paradise Lost. That is, it's the overflow of his academic work and his imagination just taking off from what he was doing academically and thinking in other directions. Other things he did during that period, the abolition of man, he was invited to give a series of lectures. And so at the University of Durham. And so these are, occasioned by an invitation. But it's interesting what he decides to talk about. Remember that the Mere Christianity begins by exploring right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. And in Abolition of Man, he explores a new idea that really values like right and wrong aren't an objective statement about the world. They're only a statement about the particular emotions of the speaker. Well, of course, that is a frontal assault on Lewis's whole apologetic for the moral argument for the existence of God. So Abolition of Man is very important to be read alongside Mere Christianity. It's much more philosophical than Mere Christianity because the audience is different. He's now delivering a series of lectures for an academic community rather than a radio audience. And so he's dealing with exactly the same matter, but he's dealing with it in quite a different way. And this was part of his genius. He could talk to anybody at any level, regardless of their background, and regardless of how much information they had, he could bring it in and land it right in your front yard.
Yes, indeed. He's such a versatile writer. So looking at the list that I have from Hooper's book, over this four-year span, he's done the Screwtape Letters, A Preface to Paradise Lost, Broadcast Talks, also known for The Case for Christianity in the U.S., Christian Behavior, Perlandra, The Abolition of Man, Beyond Personality, that's seven. And then I don't know if you officially cover the time frame that that Hideous Strength is published, but that is published in August of 1945. But seven, definitely, if not eight, within that time frame. Very envious as individuals who do writing. It's, you know, nice if you get something every couple years out. Here he had eight and in 4 years.
And it's actually more because, yes, that Hideous Strength, he wrote it during the war, and he wrote Miracles during the war, and he wrote The Great Divorce during the war, right, though they didn't appear until after the war.
Right, exactly, although the Great Divorce was out weekly, probably, I forget
that's
which,
right.
during the time frame. But yeah, now, actually, this is among his most productive time frame. Although in the 50s with the Narnia, which is not the topic of what we're covering now, is another productive spurt, but definitely fascinating time frame that when you consider, especially your eighth chapter, that's almost that's about 90 pages, if I looked correctly, in terms of, you know, how much you cover in terms of some great detail that I believe the listeners will want to get your book, definitely. Well, now, reflecting back on the process of writing The Making of C.S. Lewis, what would you say is what was your greatest joy and what was your hardest struggle?
The joy, the pleasure, was going through the primary material, that is, the letters of Lewis and letters of Warney, the diary of Warney, the letters of Dorothy L. Sayers. This biography relies heavily on the primary resources. And I have to contradict Lewis several times because Surprised by Joy is not a primary work. It's a secondary work because it's a memoir. He's remembering what had happened 30 years earlier, and he gets the basic information right, but it's not always right chronologically. And one of the things that Lewis mentions over and over in his letters is that he just really doesn't have a good sense of time and dates and chronology. Warney repeats that in his diary, that Jack just is hopeless when it comes to dates and chronology. And so it was fun to find those places where Lewis had the chronology wrong. He had the facts right, but the chronology wrong, and to find those little details was just a lot of fun. Okay. Now, as far as the struggle, I was trying to finish this book when the epidemic, the pandemic broke out. And so it was very difficult because I needed to get back to the Wade Center. Most of the primary materials for Lewis have been published now, thanks to Walter Hooper. The diary and the letters, this mammoth undertaking. But there are resources at the Wade Center that have not been published, but specifically Warney's diary. And yes, there is an abridged version of Warney's diary that Marjorie Mead published some years ago, but it's not the entire diary. And so there's gold in them thar hills. And so I'm grateful to the Wade Center. The entire staff there is so helpful. And was able to do some things at distance. And I'm just so grateful for their help, for all of us who are interested in the Inklings.
Yes, writing is a joy, but there is some struggle to it. And you had some definitely unique struggle there with the last part there with the pandemic. that definitely did impact a lot of people, and it's interesting to see how it impacted the final stages of this second book. Well, now, obviously, a third book is forthcoming. We've already mentioned that clearly. But for those listening to this before that comes out, because we're recording this here really on the day that it's being released, and this is a two-part recording that I decided to do after we started recording. But nevertheless, for those who are listening to this early on, before this third book is coming out, when might it be released and what can you spoil from it?
The book is completed. It is in the hands of Crossway, and this summer we'll be editing it. And hopefully it will be out this time next year, either May or June.
Of 2022 for those
of
listening.
Of 2022.
Yes, for those listening in like 4 years from now, it's like, oh, it was 2 years ago. But for those listening early on, you have some early information about when to look for it. And then obviously we know Narnia and so forth. Anything you can share to give us a taste of what will be in that maybe is not necessarily covered so well or much more detail that you give that others don't?
I think the post-war years were an eye-opener to me. They were very difficult for Lewis and everyone in England because the shortages continued up until 1952, 53, 54. There were food shortages, paper shortages, clothes shortages, shortages of everything. In some ways, it was more severe than it was during the war. And it just was extremely depressing. And during this time, Lewis, who had always been just a bit contemptuous of Americans, changed his mind because Americans started sending him food and clothes. And they just softened up that old English attitude towards the colonists. Of course, he wasn't English, he was Irish, but nonetheless, he had that prejudice against Americans, and that pretty much came to an end in the late 1940s, and he became quite warm to Americans and invited a number of his correspondents to spend the night with him in England at the Kilns, at his home. But during this time, of course, Mrs. Moore was deteriorating more and more mentally. Her health had been in a terrible state for a number of years, but also her mental state. Lewis wrote to several people, especially Americans. This is interesting. He may not have told Tolkien what was going on in the house, but he had several correspondents in America that he was that he kept informed of just how bad things were. And he told Sister Penelope, the Anglican nun who was an authority on Athanasius and the patristic period. He would regularly write to her about how difficult things were in the house, how it was just one constant furor and no peace at all. So that story is important to tell. And of course, it all changed after Mrs. Moore died and Lewis experienced a happiness he had never known in his life through his marriage to Joy Gresham.
An American.
How about that? She was everything. She represented everything that the Lewis of 1942 just could not stand. But people change.
Ah, yes. So obviously you'll be covering that and going into... Now, of course, there's been entire books related to her. That's not going to be the...
Yes, fine books about her.
That's going to be the single focus, but I'm sure people can look forward to a good retelling of that part in Lewis's life and other aspects. He went from Oxford to Cambridge, and so I'm sure we'll be covering that in good detail for people to learn more about. Anything else about that third book that stands out in your mind that you want to share?
Well, it becomes clear that Lewis was changing his mind also about women in general. Until the war, his conception of women was drawn largely from Mrs. Moore and her friends. And Mrs. Moore gathered around herself people, women who tended to be like her. That is, they didn't read. They weren't, I mean, they could read. They just didn't read. They couldn't engage in an intellectual conversation to Lewis's frame of mind. They loved gossip. And he was forming this image, well, all women are like this. And then during the war, he met Sister Penelope. He met Dorothy L. Sayers. He met Stella Aldwinkle. And then after the war, he met Ruth Pitter. And then finally, Joy Gresham. And they were quite different from the stereotype that he had come to accept as normal, when in fact he had been living in an abnormal situation.
All right. Well, then we definitely look forward to that. For those listening to this ahead of time, before June 2022, that's the projected release for the third book. Does it have an official title at this point?
The Completion of C.S. Lewis.
Okay.
From Bachelor to Widower.
Ah, very good. Well, now let's go ahead and wrap up this second part here by having you summarize your present book by telling why new readers about the life of C.S. Lewis and those already familiar with other biographies on him, what they can get from The Making of C.S. Lewis. Your summary point for both sides, why would they want to get a copy of your book?
Well, the subtitle tells it, from atheist to apologist, and it's small steps along the way. How does a person change their mind about the nature of the universe, the nature of reality, and how is that reflected in the character of a person? Because C.S. Lewis, after his conversion, is a dramatically different person than he was before his conversion. He became a nice person. He was not really a nice person before his conversion. And we see how this plays out and how he became more generous, more tolerant, more concerned with other people, and more conscious of the nature of temptation. So if you're a Christian, I think this book may be helpful in thinking through your own spiritual journey and recognition of the temptations that come to us in life. If you're not a Christian, I think the book would be important in dealing with a number of the major, hard, difficult issues about whether or not God exists and whether or not Jesus Christ is the Son of God.
Oh, very good. Well, again, we encourage people to consider getting a copy of The Making of C.S. Lewis, covering the years of 1918 to 1945, From Atheist to Apologist. The author is Dr. Harry Lee Poe. Well, Hal, thanks for being on All About Jack.
Thank you, William. It's always good to be with you.
Thanks also goes to you for listening to this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of the show. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including material about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard an interview I did with Dr. Harry Lee Poe, author of a book that's new for 2021 called The Making of C.S. Lewis. You'll find a link in the show notes to order that book. You'll also find links in the show notes about other podcasts Hal has been a guest on and links to copies of other books he has written. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. See the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.